Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org or Facebook and Twitter, and then on the club's YouTube channel. I'm Jonathan Curiel, journalist and author and your moderator, and it's my extreme pleasure to introduce today's distinguished speaker, Stephen Kinzer, Boston Globe columnist, senior fellow at Brown University's Watson Institute for International Public Affairs, and author of the new book, The True Flag, Theodore Roosevelt, Mark Twain, and the Birth of American Empire. Stephen Kinzer is an award-winning foreign correspondent who has covered more than 50 countries on five continents. Mr. Kinzer spent more than 20 years working for the New York Times, where his foreign postings in such locales as Nicaragua, Berlin, Istanbul, and Africa placed him at the center of historic events and at times in the line of fire. While covering world events, he has been shot at, jailed, beaten by police, tear-gassed, and bombed from the air. And it has been said of him that neither bullets, bombs, nor beating could dull his sharp determination to bring injustice and strife to light. Mr. Kinzer is here to discuss U.S. foreign policy. As President Trump's administration takes hold, what posture should the U.S. assume in the world? Drawing on his latest book, Mr. Kinzer will transport us back to the early 20th century, when the United States first found itself with a chance to dominate faraway lands. That prospect thrilled some Americans and horrified others. Their debate gripped the nation. The country's best-known political and intellectual leaders took sides. Theodore Roosevelt, Henry Cabot Lodge, and William Randolph Hearst pushed for imperial expansion. Mark Twain, Booker T. Washington, and Andrew Carnegie preached restraint. To discuss these impassioned arguments and their great relevance to the world of 2017, please give a warm welcome to Stephen Kinzer.
We have never had a president before who was destitute of self-respect and of respect for his high office. We have had no president before who was not a gentleman. We have had no president before who was intended for a butcher, a dive keeper, or a bully. No, those words were not written this week. That's Mark Twain talking about Teddy Roosevelt. They were at the heart of this first great debate over the question of America's role in the world. In some ways, they were quite different. Teddy Roosevelt was kind of a spoiled rich kid. He had never gone to school until he got to Harvard. Spent a lot of time playing with toy boats in his bathtub. He got fascinated with naval power. Roosevelt was a great believer in war. He thought war was the only noble pursuit for a man or for a country. He also had quite racist views about non-white peoples. For example, I wouldn't say the only good Indian is a dead Indian, but I would say 9 out of 10 are, and I wouldn't inquire too carefully after the 10th. Mark Twain was very different. He had traveled the world not to shoot animals, but actually to get to know people. He had been in places like South Africa, Indian subcontinent, and other places where he saw the real effects of European imperialism. He was a great lover of the native peoples who Roosevelt held in such contempt. So they were quite opposite, but in some ways they were similar. So they were both self-promoters. These were two guys who imagined themselves, and they made themselves into a persona. Neither one of them could ever turn away from a crowd or an interviewer or a photographer. Acutely aware of each other's popularity. They did not attack each other in public. Nonetheless, we know what they thought of each other from their private comments and writings. Twain considered Roosevelt clearly insane. And the most formidable disaster that has befallen the country since the Civil War. And Roosevelt returned the favor by saying he would like to skin Mark Twain alive. So what were they arguing about? It was what one senator in that period called the greatest question that has ever been presented to the American people. It was, and it still is. The question is, should the United States press its military and coercive power beyond North America, and try to influence the course of other countries. Now, all American foreign policy debates, including those we're having now, boil down essentially to one concept or one word, which is intervention. Where do we intervene? When? With what tools? With what goals? Under what circumstances? I have now immersed myself in this first great debate and realized that every argument we use, whether we're arguing for or against intervention in Vietnam, Central America, Iraq, Syria, all come from this original debate. This is the first great debate over this great question. And I think I might have been the first person in 50 years to immerse myself in this congressional record because this debate has been lost to history. I was always clear that it was this moment around 1898-99 when the United States made this fateful choice that we would decide to push ourselves into the outside world in a coercive way. But I had always assumed that this happened more or less automatically, and it just was the logical progression of our expansion inside North America. Actually, the opposite is true. As you just heard, an enormous debate broke out in the United States over this question, and the Senate convened to debate it for 32 days. And the arguments, as I said, are wonderfully valid for today. The only difference, really, as I learned repeatedly reading these speeches of the Senate debate, is that the senators were so much more articulate in those days. They're so sophisticated. Even the bad guys are brilliant. The speeches are magnificent, beautifully constructed examples of classical oratory with historical references to Pliny the Elder, the Catiline conspiracy, things you'd never dream of discussing with a U.S. senator today. So for those of you that might have forgotten a little bit about that one lesson you had in high school about the Spanish-American War, let me just set the stage for you, the historical stage. At that point in 1898, a war in Cuba had been going on for several years as Cuban rebels were fighting to overthrow Spanish rule. At the same time, William Randolph Hearst was sitting in his newspaper office in New York with the newspaper that Dad had given him. Actually, Dad won this newspaper in a gambling, in a poker game, gave the newspaper to his son, and Hearst was sitting there in New York on the way to becoming the great pioneer of what was then called yellow journalism, now called fake news. Hearst was a great purveyor of fake news. He might have been the founder of this concept, even though it had a different name then. Hearst understood something very clearly, and that was to sell newspapers, you need a running story, a story that will make people want to go to the newsstand every day and buy a paper. War is the best running story of all. So Hearst concluded, I think correctly, that if you could get the U.S. Army involved in some war somewhere, Americans would want to buy newspapers every day. So he set out quite deliberately to send the United States into that war in Cuba. He looked around. The Cuba War was going. We hadn't noticed it for several years. But Hearst decided that's the place where we can get American soldiers active. He began printing a flood of articles about the brutality, the suffering, the oppression, the tortures that were being visited on Cubans by the Spanish overseers. Many of these stories were written by people in New York who had never even been in Cuba. And the illustrations, which are quite poignant, as I saw cranking my way through all those New York journals while I was doing my research, are quite vivid of the mother and daughter falling over and dying, as the reporter is writing, in front of his very eyes from starvation and mistreatment. Then later you find out neither the artist nor the reporter was ever in Cuba. The greatest piece of fake news, of course, was the sinking of the USS Maine in the Havana Harbor. The headline on the next day's journal was, "Sinking of the Maine was the work of an enemy," and all kinds of stories explaining how the Spanish had blown up our ship. It wasn't until 70 years later that the U.S. Navy finally convened an investigating commission under Admiral Hyman Rickover, and that commission concluded that actually Spain had nothing to do with it. The Maine was blown up by a spark from inside the furnace. But that didn't matter at the time. It helped with Hearst, and his newspapers went from a circulation of 80,000 a day to 800,000. So it worked like a charm. Now, our military commanders concluded that since we would now be at war with Spain, it's possible that the Spanish naval fleet, which consisted of 10 ships, would come and attack the U.S. mainland. So in order to prevent that from happening, we had to find the Spanish fleet and sink it. We had a little trouble finding it. It wasn't in Cuba. It wasn't in Spain. We finally found it in a place that no American had ever heard of, and that was the Philippine Islands. So sure enough, under the order of Assistant Secretary of the Navy Theodore Roosevelt, we sent a squadron to the Philippines, and it sank those 10 ships, an episode commemorated by that great pillar in Union Square. Then suddenly, the shock hit Americans. The Philippines has been a Spanish colony for centuries. Now the Spanish fleet is at the bottom of the sea. So what happens to the Philippines? Do we own them now? Do we want to give them independence, which is what they've been fighting for? What about the other Spanish islands? There's Guam nearby, a nice little dimple on the ocean. Puerto Rico is over there, Cuba. And then Americans suddenly began thinking of something we had never thought about when we sent our soldiers to Cuba. And that was, do we want to begin taking colonies and projecting our military power the way European countries did? This would be something new in history. A former colony that became a nation by throwing off foreign rule, now seeking to press itself into the affairs of other countries. The U.S. finally made its decision. President McKinley decided we're going to take them all. Spain is finished. We're taking all those islands. And he imposed on Spain a treaty under which we paid them $20 million for the Philippines, and we took all the rest. That treaty had to be ratified in the U.S. Senate. And that's where this massive 32-day debate begins. Newspapers were counting every day how many votes on this side, how many votes there. There were stories on every front page, as I know, having gone through so many of them. This senator is being heavily lobbied by the Anti-Imperialist League. The other one is being offered a judgeship. How is it going to come out? Diplomats in Washington from other countries were sending back reports every day on the debate. So it wasn't just a question that affected the United States, and it certainly has shaped our national life ever since. But this was a question that shaped the whole world. Now, I mentioned that many of these arguments that were used then still recur today. Let me just give you a few examples of what I mean. The first anti-imperialist meeting in American history came in June of 1898 in Faneuil Hall in Boston. And this is the meeting that gave birth to the Anti-Imperialist League, which I now realize was a major national organization that had chapters across the country, had hundreds of public meetings, published hundreds of thousands of leaflets and pamphlets. Here's the opening speech at that anti-imperialist meeting. The policy of imperialism threatens to change the temper of our people and to put us into a permanent attitude of arrogance, testiness, and defiance toward other nations. Once we enter the field of international conflict as a great military and naval power, we shall be one more bully among bullies. We shall only add one more to the list of oppressors of mankind. So with that background, the issue became a national political campaign issue. William Jennings Bryan, the Democratic candidate for the presidency, was a militant anti-imperialist. One of his speeches included this nugget. When the desire to steal becomes uncontrollable in an individual, he is declared a kleptomaniac and is sent to an asylum. When the desire to grab land becomes uncontrollable in a nation, we are told that the currents of destiny are flowing through the hearts of men. Shame on a logic which locks up the petty offender and enthrones grand larceny. So the Senate debate began with the eyes of the entire world focused on it. The speeches, as I said, are quite stirring. And as I read a few of these lines, just think of how they play into our current debate. Here's one of the first speeches by Senator William Mason of Illinois. I'm sure these sounded even better when they were being delivered by these brilliant orators, but I'm going to try to do my best. For over 100 years, every lover of liberty has pointed to this sentence: all just powers of government are derived from the consent of the governed. This sentence has been a pillar of fire by night to the downtrodden and oppressed around the world. No, Mr. President, we will not amend that sentence now. Not liberty, Mr. President, for your family as I prescribe it. Not Austrian liberty for the Hungarians. Not Spanish liberty for Cuba. Not English liberty for the United States. And not American liberty for the Philippines, but universal liberty for which our fathers died. Immediately, Senator Albert Beveridge, another brilliant orator and a strong imperialist from Indiana, jumped up with this reply: the opposition tells us that we ought not to govern a people without their consent. I answer, the rule of liberty, that all just government derives its authority from the consent of the governed, applies only to those who are capable of self-government. By which, of course, he meant white people. This is still an argument we hear today, that countries are in chaos. They don't know how to rule themselves. We need to go over and share the great insights that we've been given on how to run countries. The idea, this was something that Theodore Roosevelt found particularly absurd, the idea that a country like the Philippines could have independence. And he cursed what he called the jack fools who seriously think that any group of pirates and headhunters needs nothing but independence in order that it may be turned forthwith into a dark-hued New England town meeting. Now, here's Henry Cabot Lodge, one of the great promoters of the imperial cause, Republican from Massachusetts. I do not believe that this nation was raised up for nothing. I have faith that it has a great mission in the world, a mission of good, a mission of freedom. This resonates through today. I remember George H.W. Bush in his inaugural speech saying that in the post-Cold War era, we'd have a new order that the United States would dominate, and we would have to dominate it because it is our job to do the hard work of freedom. This is a trope that is constantly used to lure Americans into foreign interventions. So immediately upon Lodge making this speech about our great mission of freedom, the other Republican senator from Massachusetts, George Frisbie Hoar, jumps up and replies, "You have no right at the cannon's mouth to impose on an unwilling people your Declaration of Independence and your Constitution and your notions of freedom and what is good." This is the same argument we are hearing today. One reason I was thrilled to be able to discover this episode and write about it is that I think it has a message for those of us today who feel that American foreign policy is going off in a wrong direction. The message is, we're not marginal. We're not new. These are not ideas that we just developed. This is a rich tradition in American history. We are standing on the shoulders of titans when we make these arguments. Now, all of my books are journeys of discovery. I'm always looking for some huge story that shaped the world, but that we've forgotten, that's dropped out of our history books, sometimes for very clear political reasons. So in my new book, the great discovery is that this debate ever happened. We have lost sight of the fact that we made this decision after a great national debate. And let me tell you what the outcome was. So in the U.S. Senate, 2/3 majority is required for the ratification of that treaty. It finally passed with one vote more than the required majority. One vote. And immediately thereafter, one senator became a federal judge. Another got the permission to name all the postmasters in South Carolina. Many other emoluments were handed out, to use a word that we're tossing around more these days. Then the Supreme Court was asked to rule on this question. Is it constitutional for the United States to send troops to other countries, which is not provided for in our Constitution, which also says powers not specifically given to the U.S. government in this document, it doesn't have. The Supreme Court ruled that it was constitutional, that the Constitution does not follow the flag, by a vote of 5-4. One vote. I think Americans are still caught in this duality. We've never really been good imperialists. We didn't set out to do it like the French did or the British or the Spanish. It sort of happened with the Philippines, and we had to ask ourselves suddenly what we were going to do with this. In the American soul, I think there's a great division on the question of intervention. We really want to guide the world, but we also want every country to guide itself. Now, of course, those are opposites. You can't believe both of them, but we do. And I think our new president reflects this conflicted approach to the world. One day it's, we've wasted trillions of dollars on Middle East wars and we should never go out on any more regime change operations. The next day it's, I'm putting Iran on notice and I'm going to send more troops to Syria. So you just have to wonder, what tweet did he send out last? So the great discovery I made in this book is the story of this debate. And it's a really rich and fascinating debate that, as I said, riveted the whole country. As often happens when you're engaged in a project like this, you make some other discoveries along the way that you hadn't thought of. So one of them that I made was about Mark Twain. I grew up with what I now realize is a very partial view of Mark Twain. I thought of him as Mr. Sweetheart, nice guy. He rocks on his front porch, he tells very gentle jokes, and is beloved by all. This was not the real Mark Twain. I now realize that Mark Twain was a vituperative anti-imperialist. He said that Americans fighting in foreign wars were carrying a bandit's musket under a polluted flag. He even wanted to change the flag of the United States to replace the stars with skull and crossbone symbols. Since we're talking about comments that relate to today, here's a little fragment that Mark Twain wrote more than 100 years ago. Reads almost like an obituary for the United States. This one could be written, I don't even have to tell it to you. It was impossible to save the Great Republic. She was rotten to the heart. Lust of conquest had long ago done its work. Trampling upon the helpless abroad had taught her by a natural process to endure with apathy the like at home. The government was irrevocably in the hands of the prodigiously rich and their hangers-on. The suffrage was become a mere machine which they used as they chose. There was no principle but commercialism. No patriotism, but of the pocket. So finding Mark Twain was a great thrill for me. I feel we've bleached Mark Twain's image. We've taken all the sharp edges off of his political commentary. Most of the quotes from Mark Twain that you'll find in my book do not appear in any biography or any anthology. They were lost because they conflicted with the image that posterity wanted us to have of Mark Twain. So I've been thrilled to be able to bring back a little of the real Mark Twain. And my final discovery was of a person I'm embarrassed to say I had never heard of. But as I've gone around and spoken about this guy, I've asked people if they ever heard of him. I find out nobody else has either, so I'm not so embarrassed anymore. Anybody know the name of Carl Schurz? Did you live in New York? Did you live in New York near Carl Schurz Park? Yes. He fought in the Civil War. Very good. 1848. Wow, you're like the most knowledgeable person about him that I found. When I spoke in New York at the 92nd Street Y, about half the room raised their hand, but they all said they only knew the park. And when I asked if they knew anything else about him other than the park, no. So Carl Schurz was one of the most brilliant immigrants to come to the United States in the 19th century. He had fought in the 1848 revolution in his native Germany. He had to flee, came to the United States, became an abolitionist and a supporter of Lincoln. After the Civil War, Lincoln made him a U.S. consul in Spain. When the Civil War broke out, he came back. He became a general in the Civil War. He commanded troops at Chancellorsville and Gettysburg. Afterwards, he became the first German-born U.S. senator from Missouri. Later on, he became Secretary of the Interior. He, in the late 19th century, was the best-known crusader in America for good government, civics, anti-corruption. He would have been known to all Americans during that period. And in fact, I not only have a picture of him in my book, but there's a cartoon that shows him, and he doesn't need to be identified because his face with his curly black beard was immediately identifiable to all Americans. So he's a little bit of a new hero of mine. Karl Schurz emerged as a brilliantly articulate anti-imperialist during the period of 1898, 1899. In fact, I found one letter from Andrew Carnegie after one of his speeches. Carnegie was doing whatever he could to promote the anti-imperialist cause and had actually offered to pay the U.S. Treasury $20 million to buy the Philippines so he could give it independence. Carnegie also would write to Schurz and tell him, I'll pay to have any one of your speeches duplicated by the Anti-Imperialist League and sent all over the country. So January 2nd, 1899 was the day when President McKinley submitted that Treaty of Paris to the U.S. Senate, thereby setting off this epochal 32-day debate. On that same date, Karl Schurz was delivering the convocation address at the University of Chicago. He took this occasion to address the issue everyone wanted to hear about, the debate over imperialism. And he delivered an 11,000-word speech in which he went through every argument in favor of American expansion, intervention, and foreign wars and demolished them, the political, strategic, economic, humanitarian, religious, commercial. And he also had a passage in that book, in that speech, from which I took the name of my book. So I want to conclude. I'm not going to give you the whole 11,000 words today. But here's where the phrase, the true flag, comes from. And it has also reinforced my connection to Karl Schurz. I later discovered that the U.S. Postal Service has issued a stamp for Karl Schurz. And I've bought the first day cover. Then I found out that Germany has also done the same thing. So I bought that one, too. And I now have a little mini shrine with the two first day covers. So here's Karl Schurz. Speaking to an audience in Chicago, 1899, or an audience in America, 2017. Let us raise high the flag of our country, not as an emblem of reckless adventure and greedy conquest, of betrayed professions and broken pledges, of criminal aggressions and arbitrary rule over subject populations, but the old, the true flag, the flag of George Washington and Abraham Lincoln, the flag of government of, for, and by the people, the flag of national faith held sacred and of national honor unsullied, the flag of human rights and of good example to all nations, the flag of true civilization, peace, and goodwill to all men. Thanks. Let me just add before the questions how grateful I am to the Commonwealth Club for hosting me and having a chance, giving me the chance to communicate with all of you. It's always a wonderful chance for me, a highlight of any book tour for all authors. So I feel very lucky to be here, and I think maybe you are too.
Our thanks to Stephen Kinzer, Boston Globe columnist, senior fellow at Brown University's Watson Institute for International Public Affairs and author of the new book, The True Flag, Theodore Roosevelt, Mark Twain, and the Birth of American Empire. And now it's our time for questions. We have a number of questions from the audience. And as somebody read the book, I also have a number of questions. One of the things you talk about are the revelations that you encountered in the research. One of the things that you seem to bring out is the introduction of, you call it a water cure, but in the Philippines, the American military would torture, harass, and subject Filipinos to aggressive torture. They call it a water cure, but it's basically waterboarding.
Absolutely. So the Philippine War was terribly brutal. Americans left over 200,000 dead Filipinos. We've forgotten this war completely. Most Americans have no idea that it ever happened. But it was very scarring. It was shocking to Americans. And I think it did cause us to pause. We didn't go off into next countries anymore after that. We never believed again that if we invaded another country, we'd be greeted with flowers. Oh, maybe we did, though. We faced our first torture scandal in the Philippines. And you're absolutely right about the nature of the torture, which really shows the continuity of evil in the world. So the what we call waterboarding, they then called it the water cure. Very similar techniques. I don't think I need to describe them because unfortunately you've all been reading newspapers over the last few years. But here's what I learned about that particular means of torture. It's history. It began in the Spanish Inquisition. The Spanish soldiers took it to the Philippines and used it against the Filipinos. Then, when we went to the Philippines and allied ourselves with some groups that had been allied with the Spanish, they taught this to American soldiers. The American soldiers then used it. And it became a part of the American repertoire right up to Guantanamo. So I think this torture scandal had a big impact on the American psyche, and not in a positive way. We didn't look at it and say, oh, this is awful. If this is what it's going to take for us to be a military power in the world, we better think twice. On the contrary, we decided this is the kind of thing that you have to do when you want to be a big military power in the world. It was a loss of innocence for the United States, and it's something we've never recovered.
And part and parcel of that is, I think in your book, you talk about how some U.S. military figures decided, well, Filipinos as young as 11 could be, prisoners of war, even killed.
Killed. Yes, we had, during one of the court-martials that never resulted in any punishment of anybody, it became clear that one commander in the Philippines had ordered his men to go out and kill everyone in surrounding villages who was capable of bearing arms. And when the corporal asked what age level, the guy replied, 10. Anybody over 10 has to be killed. And let me just add a footnote to this. Our interventions often seem successful at the moment, but unfortunately history doesn't stop, and we have to deal with the long-term repercussions of our interventions. The Philippines is an extreme example of this. You may remember that just a couple of months ago, the president of the Philippines announced that he didn't want to be friends with the United States anymore. He had a long tirade and said the Americans have been mistreating Filipinos and we don't want to be your friends because you hate us and so forth. So that was a little kerfluffle and it caused a little head scratching in Washington and accusations that the person was mentally unbalanced, of course. But what never came out is the answer to the question that newspapers really don't ever answer, which is why? What happened? Why did he do this? Is it just that he's mentally ill? That's what we'd like to believe. But no, while he was on this rant, the president of the Philippines was waving a photograph in his arm and he kept pointing to it as the reason to justify his decision to break ties with the United States. This was not mentioned in any of the reports I read in the U.S. press. That picture was a photo of U.S. Marines standing over a pit full of dead Filipino women and children. And he kept saying, they never apologized for this. They did this. And that was a picture taken in 1908. In 2016, it becomes a reason to reshape the geopolitical alignment of the South Pacific. So it shows you how these interventions plant destructive seeds that come to fruition many years, decades, or even generations later.
Well, and you talk in the book, and you talked very eloquently just now about the debate that happened, the debate that ensued, and the moral issues that people were discussing. And yet one of the things in your book is, you mentioned is that the Senate Committee on the Philippines, they were investigating the atrocities, or investigating everything, ultimately just did not issue a report. And in a sense, it's not a whitewashing, but it's one of the ways that history, gets forgotten.
Absolutely. So when the torture scandal exploded, senators like George Frisbee Hoar, whose quote I just read, demanded an investigation. For a time, Henry Cabot Lodge, who was the sort of Mephistopheles behind the entire imperial project, tried to stop this idea of an investigation. But the stories kept appearing, and many of them came from soldiers who had come back from the Philippines and told what they themselves had done. So then Henry Cabot Lodge, he was a brilliant strategist. He was known as the Wily One. Decided, don't beat them, don't fight them, join them. He announced, it's a good idea to have a Philippines investigation, find out the truth about this torture, and I've got an even better idea. I volunteer to be the chairman. Sure enough, he became the chairman. No witnesses were allowed on the other side. No one from the Anti-Imperialist League was allowed to testify. The Anti-Imperialists tried to bring leaders from the Philippines to come to testify. That was not allowed. And Lodge announced at the first hearing that there couldn't be any journalists attending. And the reason? The hearing room is just too small to accommodate them. So there were a couple of sporadic hearings, and then the whole thing petered out, and there was never a report. So Lodge achieved his goal. And it's a great lesson for all of us. Keep your eye on the ball. Don't let the politicians play the three-card Monte and you find out what you hope to discover has been lost in the morass of Washington.
Wow. Okay, I'll let that hang in the air for a while. You mentioned this in your talk about finding all this writing from Mark Twain that surprised you. Mm-hmm. But I think in your book you say, I mean, it might have been almost like self-squelching. I mean, a lot of the wording was for private, correspondence, but he could have made a bigger deal out of it, I guess. Is that correct?
You're right. So Mark Twain had a folder of stuff that was just too bitter for even him to publish. Also, his wife was a little tough on him, and she kept saying, I found a nice letter from her in which she says, you know, there's good things happening in the world, too. Can't you write about some of them sometimes? And my wife really fastened on to that line. She liked it. So Twain censored himself a bit, but what he said in public was plenty to make clear what his views were. I give you just one example. At one point, he had to introduce Winston Churchill at a club dinner in New York City. And all the other speeches were stressing the kinship between Britain and the United States. We have so much in common, our values, and on and on. So Twain got up, and as his toast, he said, we've heard so much about the kinship between Britain and the United States. And now that I have been in South Africa and the United States is at war in the Philippines, I see we really are kin in sin. And that was the toast that he proposed. We are kin in sin. Now we have lots more kin in the world. I do think, however, that there was a conscious effort to let the sharper edges of Twain fade away with time. Certain comments that he made during his life were reported in biographies that were published in 1920 or 1930. But after that, I think maybe future biographers began to think, it's a little tiresome, this imperialism debate. It's so irrelevant. It makes him seem like he was a partisan. It doesn't fit in with the image of Mr. Nice Guy, beloved by everyone. And so I think somehow we lost that. And I was thrilled to be able to dig up some of those quotes and actually find out that there are some great nuggets that you cannot even find on the internet, which is the opposite of what we now hear from Washington, which is everything I know, it's true because I just saw it on the internet.
Well, speaking of knowledge and so forth, one of the facts that really shocked me in the book, maybe shouldn't have, is the President of the United States, McKinley, essentially not knowing where the Philippines was. I don't think he knew what continent it was.
He said, I couldn't have told you where those darned islands are within 1,000 miles. At least he had the honesty to admit this. You know, it's always been a fantasy of mine that when I'm attending a lecture by some blowhard senator who's demanding that we invade Iran, Russia, Ukraine, Georgia, Nicaragua, Venezuela, whatever country's on the list today. My fantasy is I jump up and I say, excuse me, sir, here is an outline map of the world. Can you please point out to me where is the country that you want to invade? I truly believe it should be a rule that senators cannot vote to invade countries that they can't find on a map. And McKinley at least was honest enough to admit this. He was torn. He didn't know what to do. McKinley was a figure who was famous for following public opinion. He had risen by figuring out where people were, what they wanted, and then giving voice to what they thought. He was the opposite of a leader. He was a follower. In fact, the Speaker of the House one day commented that McKinley keeps his ear so close to the ground that it's full of grasshoppers. So McKinley had heard arguments on both sides about the Philippines. We take them, we give them independence, we just take Manila, maybe we take one island, all these different formulations. One night, he had a vision. It was undoubtedly the most influential divine visitation in the recorded history of the U.S. presidency. One night, probably in October of 1898, by McKinley's own account, he was walking at night through the corridors of the White House trying to figure out what to do about the Philippines. And he fell down on his knees and prayed for guidance. And then he wrote, he told this to another group, then suddenly it came to me. It was our job to take the islands and to civilize them as our fellow human beings for which Jesus Christ had also died. Our job was to bring them Christianity and raise them to the level of civilization. I guess he or God hadn't realized that the Philippines had been a Spanish colony for centuries, so they were Catholic already. But certainly at this moment, God sounded a lot like Teddy Roosevelt and Henry Cabot Lodge.
A reminder for our radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California program, and our guest is Stephen Kinzer, Boston Globe columnist and former New York Times foreign correspondent, who is discussing foreign policy lessons from the 20th century that might apply to the United States in 2017. He's author of the new book, The True Flag, Theodore Roosevelt, Mark Twain, and the Birth of American Empire. One of the countries, of course, you bring into your book is Cuba. We have a question from the audience about Cuba, and the question is, you know, why wasn't the U.S. essentially more enamorous of Cuba than they were of the other countries in the spectrum?
Cuba was the country that we had focused on every time from every president since Jefferson. We had our eyes on Cuba, so Americans knew something about Cuba. We didn't know anything about these other places. When the Hearst Fed frenzy began in America and demands for U.S. intervention in Cuba rose, to the shock of American senators, the Cuban revolutionaries weren't so sure they wanted American help. They were worried about the implications of having thousands of American troops in Cuba. In order to calm their fears, the United States Senate passed a law, the Teller Amendment, in which we promised that the moment Spanish power was overthrown, we would immediately withdraw and allow Cuba to have full independence. And this was not just a presidential statement, I repeat, this was a law passed by both houses and signed by the President of the United States. With that assurance, the Cuban revolutionaries welcomed American assistance, and the Spanish were gone soon thereafter. But then the Americans began to wonder whether they really should allow Cuba to become independent. We realized a couple of things. First of all, the great Cuban heroes and revolutionaries who we'd been told to admire, including in the Hearst Press, turned out to have a quality that nobody had ever mentioned to us before. They were black. So that was a little shocking for us. We didn't want to allow independence of a country where some of the leaders might be black. But it went further than that. We discovered that Cuban revolutionaries actually had a political program, not just independence. They had some idea of what they wanted to do after independence. And here were a couple of things that they wanted to do. Number one, limit the amount of land in Cuba that can be owned by a foreigner. Break up giant plantations, many of them owned by United Fruit Company, and give the land to landless, starving peasants, and then erect a tariff wall around Cuba to encourage manufacturing at home instead of imports from the United States. At that time, 90% of Cuban manufactured goods came from the U.S. So when we read that, we thought, whoa, didn't know that Cuba Libre meant all those things. In that case, we don't like Cuba Libre anymore. So what do we do? I mean, how can we get out of this promise and then still go to church on Sunday and thank God that we're not like other people? There were a variety of suggestions. One suggestion was we repeal the Teller Amendment. That would have been the honest way, but there was a reluctance. We thought that would promote a debate. We didn't want to have that debate. One of our commanders, actually the U.S. military governor in Cuba, had a great suggestion, which is, let's just rule Cuba and pretend that the Teller Amendment doesn't exist, while saying as little as possible about the whole thing. So that was kind of intriguing. But another officer in Cuba came up with a more elegant solution, which was comply with the letter of the Teller Amendment, allow Cuba to become independent, but with the caveat that we write the Constitution. The Constitution gives the U.S. the right to intervene anytime we feel like it when Cuba's not doing what we want. And by the way, we're going to choose the first president. So with that very limited amount of independence, we did allow Cuba to escape being annexed by the United States. And I can tell you this. We forgot all that. The Cubans didn't. In 1959, 60 years later, Fidel Castro won the Cuban Revolution. He came down to Santiago and he made his first speech as leader of the victorious revolution. It was quite a vague speech. He doesn't make any specific pledges, but he does say one fascinating thing. He says, I promise you that this time it will not be like 1898 when the Americans came in and made themselves masters of our country. So the burning memory of that betrayal of an American promise helped promote the victory of Castro and all that that cost the U.S. in security over the next half century.
Wow. I just No, that dovetails with an experience I had yesterday where I met a Filipino-American woman, and I was telling her I was reading your book and telling her about Aguinaldo, the leader of the Philippine Revolution, and she, of course, everyone knows his name, but she was aghast that most people in this country had never even heard of him.
Again, we feel that these interventions evaporate because we forget them. You know, there's this syllogism that teaches us that the world only exists in our own mind. Therefore, if we want to change the world, just change what you think, and everything out there will change. We need to understand that these interventions set in motion uncontrollable sequences of consequences. In the writing business, we've got various, we don't use cliches, but we have cliches to shape our business like every business does. And one thing writers always like to tell ourselves is, every story is either happy or sad depending on where you end it. The story of our invasion of Iraq is a real happy one, if you can just end it about a week after the invasion, but history doesn't allow you to do that. So we need to take that into account when we make our foreign intervention plans and realize that we can't make the story end where we want it to end.
Right. Audience member asks, returning to the subject of the Philippines and McKinley, are you aware that McKinley created a Peace Corps, quote-unquote, program to teach Filipinos English?
Yes, he did teach. He did want to teach the Americans, the Filipinos, English. However, it provoked a very interesting response from Andrew Carnegie. Carnegie wrote a brilliant article on this subject. And he refers specifically to this question of the U.S. trying to teach the Filipinos. So he starts out his article with this beautiful quote, tires the Republic so soon of its mission? And then he writes, with what hand shall we hang the Declaration of Independence in the schoolrooms of the Philippines when we have made it a crime for Filipinos to advocate for independence? So we're teaching them English, but we don't want them to learn the concepts that shaped our country.
Well, yeah, that's one question from the audience, and this is not meant as a provocation. Steve, we've had a long time to learn how to be imperialists. Why are we still doing such a terrible job?
I think it's because Americans never really jumped onto this bandwagon the way Europeans did. For a while, I did work in Africa, and I became aware of the horrible role of France in many parts of Africa. And I met a French ambassador there, and I asked him about this. I went through some of the terrible things that France has done. They did this in Rwanda and Niger and these other places. And I said to him, why do you do these things? And he looked at me with a kind of a bemused look, and he said, c'est pour la France. It's for France. You think we're here to promote the interests of Niger? That's not our business. We're here for what's good for us. Americans don't like to do that. We want to pretend that actually it's not for us. We're only doing this to help other people. In fact, we sacrifice ourselves in order to help others. So I think we are the ones that still have this delusion that we're doing good in the world. So if we are, why are we sending armies around the world and capturing nations and overthrowing governments? Well, we're told that it's for freedom and it's for our security, so we don't have to fight them at home. We get all these reasons, and the reasons sound pretty convincing, but they're not fully convincing. So I think Americans are still torn on this issue. The question of when to intervene is a very perplexing one. And I can tell you that in my business of international relations, there's something like a parlor game of trying to come up with your own list of criteria for intervention. So we should intervene when the following criteria are met. And everybody has their own lists. It's kind of a fun little job if you see how international relations specialists can think of fun. One of the best lists that I've seen come up with was by Colin Powell. His list of what should be the criteria for sending the U.S. military into action abroad. Unfortunately, he made up this list after his Iraq debacle. Maybe it was a result of that. So he came up with a list of four. If these four conditions are met, the U.S. should send military forces to fight abroad. Number one, a vital interest of the United States must be at stake. Number two, there's a clear goal and an exit strategy. Number three, the American people support this intervention. And number four, there is no way to achieve our goal other than military force. So I think that's a pretty high bar, but it's one I could accept. The United States is always going to be intervening in various ways in the world. We just need a clearer set of criteria so that we don't react emotionally without thinking through long-term effects. So I'm all for putting the interests of the United States first. All countries do that. And the only reliable foreign policy is one that's based on national interest. So I'm all for the U.S. doing what's in the interest of the U.S. My only caveat is, let's stop and think about what really is good for us over the long run and not do things that make us feel good for a few minutes, but actually wind up not only harming the target country, but sapping our own security.
Another reminder that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California program, and our guest is Stephen Kinzer, Boston Globe columnist and former New York Times foreign correspondent and the author of The True Flag, Theodore Roosevelt, Mark Twain, and The Birth of the American Empire. Several questions about the Middle East, actually. This is a good segue into that. One was, audience member wants to get your observations on Andrew Bosovich's vision of military intervention in the Middle East. You've spent a decent amount of time in Iran. You wrote a book on all the Shah's men and the coup that people have forgotten. One audience member asks whether Iran is another example, I'm sure you agree, that has stayed in people's minds for decades and yet unbeknownst to a lot of Americans.
The Iran coup, which I've written about at some length, was one of the original American sins in the Middle East. A democratic government had finally emerged in the Middle East with a constitution. There are many countries in the Middle East don't even have a constitution today. But the Mossadegh government in Iran irritated the Americans and the British, largely because it nationalized the oil reserves under Iranian soil. The British were terrified because they were losing their most valuable asset in the world, believed that they owned Iranian oil. And the Americans were worried that this could set off a terrible chain of events in the world if countries that produced resources decided that those resources belonged to them and they would only sell them at the prices they fixed, the whole world would be changed. The Americans and other developed countries needed the concept of being able to extract resources at their own under their own conditions. And they saw the nationalization of Iranian oil as a threat to that. So we sent a CIA agent into Iran. Within a few weeks, he had overthrown Mossadegh. We put the Shah in power, and really seemed like the perfect ending. We got rid of a guy we didn't like, Mossadegh, and we replaced him with a guy, the Shah, who would do whatever we wanted. Couldn't ask for more. Well, from the perspective of history, it doesn't look quite that way. Shah ruled for 25 years with increasing repression. His repression produced the explosion of the late 1970s, what we call the Islamic Revolution, that brought to power a clique of fanatically anti-American mullahs who have been working intensely and sometimes very violently to undermine American interests all over the world. That revolution also terrified the Soviets, who feared that Islamic radicalism would spread onto their southern border. That propelled them to invade Afghanistan. That brought us to Afghanistan and set off the entire debacle there. That revolution in Iran also attracted Saddam Hussein next door, Iran's big enemy. He launched a war against Iran. The United States supported him in that war. We provided helicopters and intelligence information to Saddam. That began our death embrace with Saddam that spiraled down into our present mess in Iraq, or mess in Potamia, if you want to call it that. And a lot of history came from those 3 weeks in the summer of 1953 in Iran. Yet, this is another one of those episodes that we've forgotten, even though it burns in the heart and souls of Iranians. So let me flash forward to today, just this last few days. So we had, when President Obama left office, 500 soldiers in Syria. We now have 900. So we've almost doubled within the 6 weeks of this new administration. I couldn't help thinking back. John F. Kennedy, when he took office, we had 900 soldiers in Vietnam. When he left, we had 16,000. So when I saw the near doubling of American firepower in Syria, I began to think, here we go again.
One question from the audience is has to do with neoconservatism and neoliberalism. The audience member says these are two views of globalization. Both are on the right side of the political spectrum. What view on globalization or internationalism do you encourage, and is there a progressive view of globalization?
The Washington echo chamber has come up with a series of principles about America's role in the world that everyone has to accept, or you never eat lunch in that town again. America is the indispensable nation. We have to be involved every time there's a conflict or a crisis or a confrontation anywhere in the world. Our influence is always benign. We always help other people. There's no other way to achieve this. We have to fight enemies abroad or else we'll have to fight them at home. This is a view that's shared by Democrats and Republicans, liberals and conservatives, just about every think tank in Washington, and shamefully, the press. So much reporting about the world now comes out of Washington. When there's a crisis in some country, the reporter will quickly get on the phone, call the State Department, then call the Defense Department, then call the embassy, then call the think tank, then call the congressional staff member and think, I've sure covered all the bases now. But that's just one base. They all think the same. Their suggestions of change in direction in American foreign policy are treated in Washington like the germ of some terrible plague that must be stamped out before it can infect the entire policy process. I don't think this argument about intervention versus non-intervention is really a left-right argument. I see it as an argument between prudent restraint and lustful promiscuity. That's a way to frame it, so it sounds a little better than isolationism. As I said, America's always going to be involved in the world, but our military interventions usually bring us grief. So I believe there is a constituency out there in the American public for a less interventionist, more restrained foreign policy. It hasn't been given the political or intellectual coherence that would allow it to become a major force like the Anti-Imperialist League was. Maybe after reading my book, some people will become inspired to try to regenerate that. But it is very difficult to crack through the view of American exceptionalism that tells us we are at the center of the world. This is something very American. We are compulsive activists. We need to be involved. We can't sit back and let things happen. So we have this combination of hyperactivity plus attention deficit disorder. It's a bad combination.
We have about 5 minutes left, and I wanted to ask this. I mean, you're a veteran correspondent, written a number of books, and I'm wondering how your view of the world has matured and changed since, say, you were in your 20s or maybe early 30s, when you might have had a different view of the world, and now, you know, generations or so later, your views might be, you know, radically different or not much different.
It's an interesting question. I would say I didn't change my view from one side to another, but my career experience was a great learning process. And I think that this explains why I'm always the skunk at the garden party. Why is it that I'm the offbeat every time I'm in Washington, which is as rarely as possible? I find out that it's pretty lonely out here. Although Andy Bacevich, who was just mentioned, is a sterling exception to that. It's great to have him in the trenches with me. But I believe that we need to find a way to crack out of the tyranny of people whose backgrounds in foreign policy is that they all went to the same international relations schools, then they read the same textbooks, they had the same professors, they went to work for the same members of Congress, and they now go to work for the same think tanks. They become quite monochromatic. That's the reason you have this repetition of these same tired cliches generation after generation in Washington. I didn't have that experience. My experience in learning about the U.S. role in the world came from the perspective of the victims. I was a foreign correspondent. I didn't spend my time in Washington reading papers about what's really happening in Nicaragua and who's on top and what we have to do. I was there. And I could see the effects of these interventions. And I saw that time after time in so many countries that I visited. So my view that interventionism is a dangerous path is shaped by what I saw and what many people in Washington have never seen. I don't get the geopolitical point of making people suffer on a grand scale. In 2011, President Obama and Secretary of State Clinton refused to participate in Kofi Annan's mediation mission to stop fighting in Syria. Reason, we're not negotiating with Iran or with a Syrian government. So our desire to make our geopolitical point, which is no Russia should be in the Middle East, Iran should not have influence, was so important that it was worth the deaths of huge numbers of Syrians and the destruction of that country. When you're living in places like that, when you've spent your career seeing the effect of these decisions, you're a lot slower to push the button.
For our last question, I'm gonna compile two questions into one, speaking of which, one audience member asks if there's any rationale to take preventive action in North Korea. And the other question is about how can we get the American public beyond fake news, classes on propaganda in high school, overthrows as text. You've talked about how lies sell. What's the solution in 1 minute?
North Korea, briefly, it's a real conundrum for American foreign policy. The one thing I would say is the only way it can be resolved is with the other countries that are near North Korea, which means Japan, South Korea, and China. We have to work with them. And the Chinese are very unhappy about our new missile system in South Korea. They don't want to cooperate with us. We got to think this through now. If we want to curb North Korea and prevent disaster from emerging from North Korea, we have to work with and compromise with some of North Korea's neighbors. As for what we can do, my former colleague Cy Hirsch used to get this question after his speeches, and somebody would get up always and say, "Oh, you're so right, everything is so awful, what can we do?" And he liked to lean into the microphone and say, "Nothing." I don't like that answer. And in fact, one of the encouraging things I've seen in recent weeks, and I say this as one who's on a college campus a lot, is that there's a burst of enthusiasm among people of a generation who grew up with Obama and believed that American policy was always going to be going more or less in that direction, and that every protection that we've established in this country is going to be permanent. They're realizing now that isn't true. So I think there really is a chance that that burst of protest we saw in the first days of the new administration could morph into something quite large. We might see in our dreams a resurgence of something that we saw during the Vietnam period. I think there's a great potential out there for civic involvement that hasn't been out there for a long time. And boy, do we need it.
Our thanks to Stephen Kinzer, Boston Globe columnist, senior fellow at Brown University's Watson Institute for International Public Affairs, and author of the new book, The True Flag, Theodore Roosevelt, Mark Twain, and the Birth of American Empire. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and the internet, and we wish to remind everyone here that copies of Stephen Kinzer's book are for sale. He'll be pleased to sign them following the program. I'm Jonathan Curiel, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.